This week on the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we have a special hour-long episode. We discuss a range of clinical topics, including how to comply with CMS and accreditation requirements in the pharmacy area, how to decrease opioid use in your center, improve patient outcomes, and reduce costs. And we will discuss an anesthesiologist's perspective on appropriate patient selection. We also update you on the latest news and keep you informed of upcoming ASC-related events. This week's episode is also eligible for one AEU credit for CASC-certified individuals. Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This week's episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading full-service ASC regulatory compliance consulting firms, and the Regulatory Compliance series of books for ASCs by John Gailey and published by Eden Group Development.
Welcome to episode 23 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for June 4th, 2018, recording from our studios in Rochester, New York, with interviews from the New York State Association meeting in Albany. This is Jenna Alvarez, Senior Nurse Consultant with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, and I'm here with Sue Cronkite, also a Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and John Gailey, the owner of AHS and Eden Group Development, and one of the nation's leading ASC industry experts in regulatory compliance, finance, and administration. He's the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry and a frequent national speaker on all aspects of the ambulatory surgery center management. Welcome, everyone. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. This is take two since I kind of messed up a good 5 or 6 minutes of this. So hopefully it'll go better. You know, we reached a major milestone this week. We hit 2,500 downloads of our podcast, which is great to see that people are listening to us. And it's a very exciting time for us knowing that people are listening, given the amount of time that we spend working on this every week. So thank you for all of our loyal listeners. Thank you for all of the people that are subscribed to our channel here. And thank you for our sponsors, Eden Group Development, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. And shortly, we're going to have some individual sponsors for various episodes, including Priority One Group coming up in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So
talking about that, we've had a lot of comments in person when we're out, people mentioning that they've been listening to the podcast. But this week, we've actually had a couple of listeners write in some comments, which is really nice.
So one of our listeners sent a comment in during the week, which, Sue, I thought was kind of interesting. It had to do with the EMR area, which we talked about during one of the recent podcasts. Yep. And she mentioned that she was intrigued to hear that lawyers were saying that they would much prefer to defend a paper medical record rather than an electronic medical record. Her organization is in the process right now of converting from paper to electronic. I think they're making decisions right now as to what whether they wish to do that and looking at some options.
Yeah, sort of weighing the pros and cons.
Right.
There's a lot to think about.
Yeah, so the episode was particularly enlightening for her, and I think it also was enlightening for her to see that many ASCs right now, if not most ASCs right now, are still in paper. So I'm glad that we could provide that information to her. She also seems to have an awful lot of experience with electronic medical records with the practice that that her ambulatory surgery center is affiliated with. So as we talked about before, you really have to realize that moving to an electronic medical record could have some ramifications, negative ramifications, at least in terms of the legality of those records or the types of issues that you might write into if you are sued. And let's just talk about our week. Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies has two of our 30-some-odd centers that are being surveyed this week. So one by a state and one by an accrediting organization. So that's going to keep me at those centers for 3 days. And Sue, you're coming with me for the state survey. I think I'm doing the other one on my own. And then we have one pending, don't we, Jenna?
I'll be on standby.
That's right. So, yeah, we have a center that's opening up, and they're expecting their early option survey very soon. So let's hope everything goes well. They're certainly prepared for it. but always that anxiety that comes with waiting for the surveyors to show up. So it's going to be a busy week for us. By the way, I know you nurses had your week. This is Healthcare Executives Appreciation Week. So I didn't see it on the news like Nurses Week was. But since most of our listeners are could be termed healthcare executives, I just thought I would bring that up. By the way, in looking at various recognized weeks and months, I found it very interesting. This is, I think this is National Cat Lovers or Hug a Cat Week, a month. So
you have there to be careful doing that.
Very, very busy month, I can see. So another important thing to note is this is our first extended podcast. Podcast is going to be over an hour, which allows us to offer administrator educational units, which are AEUs, which the CASC credential requires for ongoing certification of your CASC credential. So if you're CASC certified and wish to get one AEU in the area of delivery of patient care, go to our website at www.ascpodcast.com and follow the links for AEUs. And you'll need to provide a code that we're going to provide later in this episode on that page, as well as the name that you wish printed on your certificate, and then pay a nominal $35 fee for the service. And we're very excited. We're going to have another one in about a month. And of course, we have a premium podcast coming up very shortly. Sue and I are finishing up recording the first one, which is on governance. So Sue, what's up in the news?
So John, this week I read an article from Johns Hopkins by researcher Susan Hutfliss about a higher than expected rate of infection due to colonoscopies. They were looking at E. coli and Klebsiella. It's long been believed that there was a very, very low rate of infections due to the colonoscopies.
I was actually quite surprised when I saw the results when we talked about it earlier, because we've always glossed over this in the quality improvement meetings. When we talk about the number of infections, we just assume there won't be any. This information actually pretty much shocked me when I saw it. So, yes.
So they found with screening colonoscopies, a rate of 1 per 1,000. It was a little higher, 1.6 per 1,000 for non-screening colonoscopies, and EGDs were 3 per 1,000.
So that's a significantly higher rate than we see in any of our centers, right?
Not surprisingly, patients who had been recently hospitalized for some type of infection had a rate of 45 per 1,000. So just something to keep in mind if somebody is coming into your center for a screening and they've recently been sick, that would be something to check for. They did say, which is good news, ASCs with the highest volume of procedures had the lowest rate of infection. So it goes back to what we've been saying, and a lot of people realize just the more you specialize and, you know, kind of the better you get.
Right.
At it. And there were, you know, ASCs that really had quite a higher level of infection. So
I would imagine if you only do a few a week or such, you probably don't have as much expertise in that area.
And I know we were talking about how do people know that their patients are having infections afterwards? There's not always follow-up. And if you don't know, how do you even know you have a problem and try to improve that? So, you know, they were mentioning a lot of times without the EMRs, you're not going to know that your patient then went to the ED within, you know, that next month.
Well, even with an EMR, if our system isn't tied into another system or a national system, which is most likely the case, it's going to be very difficult to find it.
So. Yeah, and how much you're even allowed to, you know, how often can you even check once the patient is no longer in your care? So that certainly isn't the answer to it.
Well, and looking, Jenna, at the way we accumulate data in our quality improvement program, what we do is we rely on, you know, a monthly
physicians reporting.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we send a report to our physicians on a monthly basis usually, and we get back that information. But doesn't that seem to be a problem if the physician is probably the GI doctor is most likely not the person that's probably going to hear about the infection?
It's very true.
Right. So, I mean, we talked about this quite a bit before the podcast here. And I think one of the things that we talked about was maybe we need to look at better patient education, because I mean, I think it is important that we get this data, that we know if we have an infection or if our patients are going to have an infection. And one way to do that perhaps is on our discharge summary. Maybe we need to emphasize, please call us or please send us an email or a letter or whatever indicating that you had some complication afterwards so that we can track this data. I think it's important that we be able to track this information. We certainly have a responsibility to do it as part of our follow-up on our patient care, but clearly we don't know. I've never seen these statistics this high before, so I don't think the current system that we're using to gather that information is working particularly really well. So I think we need to look into this a little bit more.
Yes, you won't know to address the problem if you don't know that you have one. And right. I think what your point about educating the patient is a really good one, because with GI doctors, a lot of times, especially with just a screening thing, you may not see that doctor until your next screening
right.
time. So it isn't something where there's a lot of follow-up always.
Right. We're going to have to be more proactive. I hope it doesn't get to the point where we're going to be having to make phone calls to the patient a month afterwards to find out if they had that. That's certainly not the standard of care right now. But
no, we had talked about that a little bit, but it's really the incidence is still fairly low.
Small,
so
right.
does it really make
right.
sense?
It's not time to panic.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a short break. We'll come back with our discussion of pharmacy. So let's start by doing a quick review of the various regulations, accreditation standards. I know in previous podcasts we've talked about this, but since not all of our listeners would have listened to previous podcasts, and it's always good to kind of repeat it anyway. So we'll start with the CMS regulations. Jen, I'll start with this, and then maybe you'll talk about the accreditation standards. So this is 416.48 of the conditions for coverage. The area is referred to as pharmaceutical services. An ASC must provide drugs and biologicals in a safe and effective manner in accordance with the accepted professional practice and under the direction of an individual designated responsible for pharmaceutical services. And the standard is that drugs must be prepared and administered according to established policies and acceptable standards of practice. Adverse reactions must be reported to the physician responsible for the patient and must be documented in the record. Blood and blood products must be administered only by physicians or registered nurses. And orders given orally for drugs and biologicals must be followed by a written order signed by the prescribing physician. Couple notes here. When we refer to the direction of an individual designated responsible for pharmaceutical services, we're not referring to a pharmacist here, because a pharmacist is not on site all the time. If you have a pharmacy consultant, they're very likely to be consultative and maybe come in once a month or once a quarter or less frequently. And many states, by the way, don't even require you to have a pharmacy consultant. But the individual that is going to be designated, and we need to have this designation in writing by the governing body, is most likely going to be a physician who orders the drugs or is responsible with his drug license for the drugs in the facility. So don't forget to do that in your designations every year as who is the director of pharmaceutical services. So moving on to our interpretive guidelines for 416.48, the standard for administration of drugs. We should note that the words accepted professional practice and acceptable standards of practice mean that drugs and biologicals are handled and provided in the ASC in accordance with applicable state and federal regulations, as well as standards established by organizations with nationally recognized expertise in the clinical use of drugs and biologicals. Jenna, perhaps the most notable organizations would be ISMP and USP. The Institute for Safe Medication Practices, ISMP, at their website at ismp.org, publishes lists of look-alike and sound-alike drugs and high-alert drugs. Do you want to talk just a little bit about the look-alike, sound-alike list?
Sure. So they have two different lists, actually, for look-alike, sound-alike. They have one that is just a list of the look-alike, sound-alike drugs, and they also have another one, which is really nice, that has the tall man lettering for the different look-alike, sound-alike. So
what do you mean by tall man lettering?
So one of the recommended ways to differentiate between look-alike, sound-alike drugs is to label the medications using tall man lettering, which uses capital and lowercase letters to distinguish the words from each other.
Right. So it kind of emphasizes the pronunciation and the differences there. So you're using capital and lowercase letters on the label that you should be putting on the shelves. By the way, that's an important thing. I've actually seen a number of places lately that are not labeling, which I always thought was, you know, kind of the standard of care, but definitely you should be labeling the shelves with the appropriate drug label so that we know what drugs are on that shelf and where to put them, you know, when a new box comes in, especially if you liquidated all the ones that were on that shelf before.
Well, and that way, when you have the drugs come in, you're not accidentally putting look-alike, sound-alike drugs
That's
next
right.
to each other if you know that they have to go in certain places.
Right.
So, and then they also have the lists of the high alert medications. And I believe on previous podcasts, we talked about this, but there is two lists. One is the acute care setting and one is the ambulatory and the outpatient setting one. And after discussion with our pharmacy consultant, we came to the conclusion that the best one to use in surgery centers is the acute care setting one, because the ambulatory is really meant more for offices
right.
and oral medications that people are prescribing as opposed to the acute medications that people are using during surgery. So it doesn't have all of the cardiac medications that you have on hand in your center in the event of an emergency.
So Jenna, is it appropriate just to post this list from ISMP on your, I open up a lot of these drug cabinets when I'm doing a survey. Is it just appropriate to put that whole list up on the wall?
No, and you know what? We were actually talking about this with a client recently. So whereas with the look-alike, sound-alike drugs, you can just kind of search the drugs you have and make sure that they aren't.
Yeah.
You actually have to go back and remember all of those pharmacology classes that us nurses have had to take and remember which class of drugs each of your drugs are, because it doesn't actually tell you which drugs specifically you need. It goes by drug class.
Oh, so great. Yeah, it's a very long list. So the takeaway is you definitely need to go in and figure out which ones are in your formulary and which ones are on your shelves.
Yep.
And I think it's also important to go out and buy those relatively cheap labels that indicate look-alike, sound-alike, and high-alert drugs, and just use those labels on the various shelving there. Mm-hmm. And if necessary, put them on the vials, too, if there's such a low volume of it. So again, that we'll put this on our website, but the website for the Institute for Safe Medication Practices is ismp.org, and definitely look at that. And
the other important part about that is just creating a list isn't enough, and I think ISMP even had an article about this. Your list is pretty useless without having your mitigation
protocols.
Strategies.
Yeah, what do you
so
do?
That's another part of both Joint Commission and AAAHC is that you need to have a way to prevent errors from occurring with your high alert drugs.
Right. So moving on to the other most frequently referenced acceptable standards of practice is the USP, or better known as the U.S. Pharmacopoeia, which publishes USP 797, which has a lot of very interesting things that we have to follow, especially talking about multi-dose, single dose, and the issue of compounding. Jenna, we've talked about this in previous podcasts also, where we've noted that you can only mix up to two different drugs. Once you reach three drugs, then it becomes a compounding situation where it has to be done by a pharmacist, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So USP 797, keep a copy readily available for yourself, or refer to our previous podcast where we talked a little bit more about that. Jenna, just very briefly, what does AAAHC have to say about pharmacy?
Well, there's an entire chapter on it. So they have
Chapter 11 for everyone that's AAAHC.
They have the similar requirements as CMS, requiring that it's under a licensed provider. And again, it doesn't specify it needs to be a pharmacist. This can be one of the physicians at your facility.
Right.
Then they, again, say that they need to be provided in accordance with ethical and professional practice, laws and regulations, which we just discussed. So they have a section on prevention of errors from lookalikes and soundalike and high alert drugs, as we just discussed as well. And then they have a section on drug storage and security and record keeping. Important part of this is that if you are still using prescription pads, you need to make sure that those are controlled and secured from unauthorized access. And the most recent addition actually specifies that you need to, in policy, specifically prohibit pre-signed or post-dated prescriptions. I don't think that was actually specifically stated before. I think it was part of the, you need to secure your prescription pads.
Right, right.
They discuss medications and vaccines, if present, needing to be segregated into organized labeled storage areas designated to minimize drug selection errors. So as we talked about with your high alert and our look-alike, sound-alike drugs, making sure that those are separated in ways that people aren't going to pull the wrong medication. Another important part in this section is if you have a high alert medication present for which there is an antidote, rescue, or reversal agent, the agent must be stocked in the same area as the high alert medication so that if something happens with that high alert medication, you have the reversal agent
immediately available.
Okay, the other requirements that I think we've talked about in previous podcasts, but they've really made specific this year, is making sure that if not immediately administered, any medication that is removed from the original packaging is labeled in a standard format in accordance with law, regulation, and standards of practice. And they specifically want the drug name, the drug strength, the amount, if not apparent, from the container, the expiration date and time, and the name or initials of the person transferring the drugs. And they want this actually also written into your policy.
This is a huge issue for many of our centers, and I know it's also one of those areas that I have to cite, unfortunately, pretty frequently when I'm doing a survey myself. So yes, definitely need to make sure those that labeling is done appropriately.
And lastly, having a written policy in place regarding the disposal or return of expired, damaged, and recalled medications. So you should always have a policy on how to handle recalls. And then the expired and damaged medication, how are you going to separate those medications from the rest so that they're not accidentally used? And how are you going to return them or dispose of them once you've identified them?
Moving on to Joint Commission, this is in the medication safety section.
So again, Joint Commission has a whole section on safely managing high alert and hazardous medications and having in writing a policy to address high alert and hazardous medications. They also have a section on look-alike, sound-alike medications, which is similar to AAAHC, and recommend using the same ISMP to designate your medications in your facility. Then they also want you to have specific criteria for determining what medications are available for dispensing administration and having that list written out. Okay, so Joint Commission also requires that you have a process in place for addressing medication shortages and outages to the practitioners who work at your facility, as well as having a plan for substitution protocols in the event of a medication shortage, which I know has been a big issue this year.
And last year. And the year before.
Specifically this year, just with the
more common drug and IVs now, which have been a big issue.
Joint Commission has a lot in common with AAAHC. They also have a section about expired or unused medications that need to be returned, or about recalled medications that have the similar requirements. They also talk about safe administration of medications, safe storage of medications, and they just go into a lot more detail that I think is going to take up too much time for our listeners.
So, at least for this episode.
So the requirements are really just making sure that you are safely administering medications, you are safely ordering medications, you are safely storing your medications, and you are safely disposing of your medications.
Okay, so let's move on to the major issues in pharmacy. So let me start with refrigeration, one of my favorite topics. Drugs that have to be refrigerated have to, the refrigerator needs to be monitored. And that just doesn't mean looking at the temperature once a day, by the way. So the issue here is you want to make sure that the temperature monitoring is occurring 24/7. There's a couple ways to do that. You know, having a temperature gauge that monitors and alarms whenever the temperature goes outside of the range. Another easier way to do this is to have a thermometer that has minimum and maximum so that you can look, you record on a daily basis the current temperature, the minimum temperature, and the maximum temperature during the period since the last recording. And then if the temperature falls outside of the acceptable range at any time during that period, then you have to address the issues of whether those drugs need to be disposed of that were in there, depending upon what the manufacturer's instructions would be.
And I think that's one of the things that people struggle with the most. They have these logs, and then they're not actually appropriately following up afterwards. There is something out of range.
And this could be quite serious, especially when you're dealing with something like immunizations. Like our flu vaccine, for example, has a very specific and very tight range, and falling outside of that range could result in that drug becoming no longer viable. So definitely keep a very good log. We're going to be looking for it as a surveyor when we come in, and we're going to want to make sure that the employees have been trained as to what to do if the temperature falls outside of that range. Jenny also mentioned earlier recalls, which you have to have a system in place for drug recalls. You need to document that system. So what do you suggest as a means of doing that?
Having a policy in place and then following your policy.
It's your answer for everything, isn't it? I put her on the spot. As we're recording this, her eyes went wide, and like I guess she wasn't prepared for that, even though she's the one that creates most of those. Yes, yeah, so certainly having a very good policy in place, making sure that somebody is designated to look for the recalls, and you can do that both proactively and reactively. Proactively meaning you go to websites to determine what's being recalled, and reactively meaning that you look at your emails, look at the mail for any information that came from the manufacturers and from your distributors for drugs that have been recalled. We should also probably talk quickly about wasting drugs. I've noticed that, what was it, Jenna? I think this last week we were at a center where there were drugs inside of vials in a sharps container, and that's not acceptable. So, important to note that you need to be wasting those drugs prior to putting the sharps into the sharps container. There should be no vials with any liquids inside those sharps containers.
Yeah, and actually, I'll admit, as a new nurse, and probably for quite a few years, I did not realize that those sharps containers do not actually get incinerated.
That's correct.
So I always thought, oh, yeah, throw it away and it's going to get incinerated anyways. What's the point? We would draw up the medication and waste it, but if we did have a little bit of medication left in, we never really thought much about it. And I found out recently in one of the conferences when they had someone do a whole topic on wasting of medications and hazardous medications especially, no one really actually took the time to explain it to me before. Yeah. You know, in the hospital, we would have like this black box and this blue box and this red box, and there would be a sign, and this is the one you're supposed to put this in. And no one actually explained to me why you had to put things
into different boxes.
Right. And it was fascinating. It was an hour and a half talk, and I was like, oh my God, I totally have like misunderstood things for 5 years.
Yeah. Well, it's because you were working in the hospital. So definitely, you know, look up the rules. And by the way, there are different rules sometimes in different states with regard to wasting drugs too. Really, we're discouraging wasting the drugs into the public system, like, you know, down the drain. That's really no longer an acceptable practice. We can't have any conversation about pharmacy without having a conversation about drug shortages. It's a major problem. Right now, fentanyl, morphine, and lactated ringers and saline are probably the most major ones that affect any of our surgery centers. I just before the episode aired here, I checked the website. Indeed, lactated ringers and saline are still a major issue. I believe the issue with those isn't so much the fluids, but it's actually the bags that they're put into, which the manufacturers were largely destroyed in Puerto Rico during the hurricane. But keeping on top of the drug shortages, you know, this is another area where it might be wise to have a pharmacy consultant. I know anybody that's has a drug shortage problem in their center is on the phone every day with their distributors to try to find alternate sources. But having a pharmacist that can help you find these sources, they might have more knowledge about it, and also having them give you information about alternative drugs. Unfortunately, that's what it's coming down to now, is what alternatives are out there. So, Sue, in a recent article or recent research that you did, somebody mentioned that we need to have me to revise our standing orders or pre-populated drug orders, right?
Yep, just keeping that in mind if you have to change any of your medications. Sometimes it's just a compounded drug that you maybe are changing by one or two components, but just remembering to look at your standing orders.
Make sure you modify them so that they're accurate now. It's way too easy for us to. That. Yeah, it's way too easy to kind of forget that we have those things there and we just kind of automatically go off and sign off on them. So, yeah, definitely a very good idea. So what are the problems that I have in surveys? The most common one in almost every survey I do is keeping an eye on those, especially the anesthesiologists, making sure that they're labeling their syringes, as you mentioned earlier, Jenna, with the drug, the dose, the initials, and the date. You will be cited if you do not label those syringes that are not used immediately. In other words, and by that I mean you didn't put them down. You know, using immediately means that you took the drug out of the vial and used it without putting them on the table. This is just a very common problem, but it is a very serious one. I walked into a center a couple weeks ago, and there was a syringe sitting. There were two syringes sitting on the anesthesia machine. One was quite obviously propofol, but the other one I could not tell, and no labels on them at all. And I quickly pointed out to the organization that this was a major problem, and we brought the anesthesiologist in, who kind of indicated that he didn't know that he needed to do this. I don't know how many times we have to repeat this, but make sure your organization, make sure your physicians and your anesthesiologists are aware of it. Single dose and multi-dose, keeping on top of that. There are still organizations out there that are not following the rules, that are using single dose vials in multiple patients. That is totally inappropriate. That could be an immediate jeopardy situation. So be very careful there. I'm still shocked when that happens. And Jen, do you want to talk a little bit about multi-dose and how there's special rules about multi-dose?
Yeah, so some of these also do depend on state by state, but the general rules are that if you are using a multiple dose vial on multiple patients, you need to be drying up the drugs in a non-patient care area. So if having a central medication area away from your where you're actually at the bedside.
And to be clear, that's in all states, the requirement of a non-patient area.
There are more specific. I know when I was in Nevada, there was much more strict rules.
About what could even be drawn up out of a, in other words,
multi-dose vial. We mostly, where I worked, used multi-dose vials only for single patients.
And that's a very good policy to have, I think. It's unfortunately, it can be very expensive.
It's an expensive one.
Right.
Especially, in, you know, when I was an inpatient with hospitals and you had one insulin vial that had a 30-day supply of insulin on a patient that you're only going to have for a day or two. But it's the safest way.
So when we say can't be in a patient care area, does that mean that if we're in the operating room, we can draw up the drug in the room while there's no patient in the room?
No.
That's correct. Trick question. Yes. I mean, when we say non-patient care area, it means that that drug has to be drawn outside of the operating room. You can't, even if there's no patient in there, you cannot be drawing that drug up during in that room. And of course, we need to make sure that there's appropriate labels on the syringes, as well as labeling the if you're using a multi-dose vial, that vial needs to be labeled with the date that that it expires, which is based upon the manufacturer's instructions, or 28 days, I believe, is the requirement after that.
And if you are, as we talked about, using a multiple dose vial on a single person, you can draw that up at the bedside. So correct. That is the one benefit, I guess, of it's expensive way to do it, but it is convenient that you can draw that up at the bedside if you are using it only for that patient.
And as our policy guru, is it necessary to put this into policy?
So it is necessary to put in policy, and be careful about your policy. At a recent conference, someone pointed out that a lot of people are saying that they're following the one and only campaign.
Yeah.
And someone was saying that they were cited because they do use the one and only campaign, but when they were doing their annual health tests for their employees, they did use a multi-dose vial on their own employees. I can't remember if it was for the flu vaccines or for when they were doing the TB testing.
Yeah.
But they had to then go back and write a specific exception to their own policy because that was caught. So just be careful before you make general statements in your policy manual that if there are exceptions, that you are putting those exceptions.
And that could be said for everything, not just pharmacy, I guess. Okay, let's take a break and we'll come back for a couple interviews that we recorded during the New York State Association of ASCs conference in May.
One of the sponsors of the ASC podcast with John Gailey is Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. John, can you tell us about some of the services that AHS offers?
Sure. So we are a regulatory oversight organization. We basically are involved in the business of helping organizations to always be prepared for surveys and to respond to surveys and just to become your outsourced regulatory compliance organization. We also do financial oversight too, but the stuff that's probably most pertinent to most of our listeners relates to regulatory compliance and accreditation compliance. So our goal is always to have our organizations remain prepared for surveys. And so we'll, to that end, we maintain the policy manuals. We develop educational programs. We can even do the educational programs for the organization. We oversee the quality improvement program. We write the minutes for the quality improvement program, if that's what the organization wishes. And we help run the governing body meetings, again, if that's what the organization wants. And we'll write the governing body minutes for that. We also do periodic mock surveys. We help the organization through a survey, and we'll help them respond to the plan of correction necessary after a deemed status survey. And most importantly, this is all at a fixed price that might surprise most of our listeners.
Hey, so how do our listeners learn more?
So for a free, no-obligation consultation, give me a call at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And you can also visit our website at www.ah-strategies.com and fill out the contact us form.
Okay, thanks, John.
During the spring New York State Association of ASCs conference in May, we were able to speak to Dr. Gary Schwartz, an anesthesiologist who spoke at the conference about opioid use in an ASC setting. As we know, the opioid epidemic is a major national crisis, and it does have a major impact on healthcare providers. Providers are continuing to try to find ways to provide appropriate pain management while reducing the chance of addiction. ASCs are certainly not immune to this issue, and Gary's session discussed ways an ASC can address this issue. So let's listen to the interview. So I'm here at the New York State Association Conference in Albany, and we're talking to Gary Schwartz, MD. He's the Director of Acute Pain Management with AABP Integrative Pain Care. Dr. Schwartz is board certified in pain management and anesthesiology. Sue, you attended his session here, and you have a couple questions for him to talk about this issue.
I just found it really interesting. I know we've talked about on podcasts before. It's frustrating because you don't really know what to do about it. He was talking about alternatives to opioid medication. And I know one of the things he mentioned is often the gateway to addiction can be getting their medication at the hospital, at an ASC, and it sometimes will lead into addiction. So stopping it at the beginning can really be the best way to address this. So some of the things I'd like him to talk about are some of the other benefits of avoiding opioids. As I said, we all know about the epidemic, but there were other benefits to the ASCs, efficiency, and that kind of thing that maybe he could talk a little bit about.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about it. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, John, for having me as a guest on the ASC podcast. I'm a big fan, and I appreciate being here at the New York State Conference today of Ambulatory Surgery Centers. As anyone's reading your local newspaper, the national news, you throw on CNN, you see the opiate epidemic on a daily basis. It's unfortunately, you see physicians getting arrested, you see patients dying. A lot of us, unfortunately, know of a family member or a friend who could have been dependent or even addicted to these medications. And the best way to prevent it is obviously to not start at the beginning. We have a lot of different resources like nerve blocks, local anesthetic infiltrations, newer medications like long-acting liposomal bupivacaine that a surgeon and anesthesiologist could use to help prevent the patient from even having pain after the surgery so they don't even need to think about taking these medications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was surprised to hear how long some of those blocks can last. You said 72 hours?
Up to 72 hours of a sensory pain relief, which is important because it allows your body to heal from the operative procedure. Normally, for the majority of surgeries, after 48, 72 hours, a patient's ambulating, meaning they're walking around, they're feeling better. If they can get by with just your local ibuprofen, Motrin, Aleve-type medications, or acetaminophen, they have less nausea and vomiting, they move around better, they can interact with their family and friends, less constipation.
Again, as you were talking about the benefits to the surgery center, less time in the PACU.
It's tremendous. They get faster time in the operating room because you could use less anesthetics on the patient so they can wake up faster. A lot of these procedures, we don't even have to manipulate the airway. So you could do under deep sedation or general anesthesia without an airway device. So the patient has less sore throat, less nausea, vomiting. They wake up faster. They get to the recovery room, the PACU, the post-anesthesia care unit, more awake, happier, less pain, and they could leave faster. So most surgery centers will operate in a 7-to-5 type of environment. They could do more cases. It also is easier. You're required by law to call and follow up on your patients the next day. It's a lot easier to make a phone call. Hey, how you feeling? I'm feeling great. I don't have nausea. I don't have constipation. I don't have any pain. I'm going to tell my neighbor next door what a great experience I've had.
Yeah, free advertising, kind of, because, you know, a lot of good results. Free. Everybody's happy.
I guess, so this seems so logical to me. I'm not clinical like the two of you are, but as you know, speaking kind of as an administrator in the past, why aren't we all doing it this way?
Well, there's a couple of big reasons. One, we need support of the administration like yourself. There is some cost involved with it. So for any type of nerve block or local anesthetic infiltration, you need the local anesthetic, which is your typical bupivacaine and marcaine. Now they have newer local anesthetics like liposomal bupivacaine, which could last up to 72 hours. For the nerve blocks, you need a needle to place the nerve blocks. You need the skin technical skills of the anesthesiologists who are able to perform these, where most people are able to now, and also the ultrasound equipment. But as technology improves, the cost of all these type of things, the benefit is worth all the cost. And now, as I mentioned during my talk, there's even some ultrasound companies that you could have portable ultrasound machines that you could rent for $200 to $300 a month as a payment plan that could be hooked up to your iPad or your tablet. So it's portable. So if you have multiple centers or multiple rooms, it's easy for the anesthesiologist or the surgeon to move along and go with it.
Now, this also seems to have a benefit to society, not just in terms of reducing our opioid problem, but also in terms of cost to our healthcare system.
A tremendous amount of cost to the healthcare system. So about almost 99% of patients undergoing a surgical procedure will receive opiates postoperatively. So from a direct cost, some sort of insurance or the government is paying for these medications to be administered. Out of these medications, about 80 to 90% of the patients do not use the full amount. So those get diverted to the streets. They get stolen. People sometimes abuse them. And that leads to societal costs of people getting arrested for these medications, overdose, prolonged hospital stays. It's a downtrending system that has large, large costs.
So when you're working with ambulatory surgery centers, and you work with a number of them, right, and office-based, I believe, too, right? But so how do you approach this with administration and with the medical director in that organization?
So we're pretty lucky is that we work with Jeffrey Frin over at Gramercy Surgical Center in Manhattan and Queens. We have a long-standing tradition of AABP of working with our surgeons, implementing these procedure-based practices into the system. We meet with the surgeons. We meet with the administrators. We say, these are the systems that we need in place. This is what we could do for you. We could save you money. We can have more throughput, more cases, mm-hmm. and everyone benefits. We're lucky now in our organizational spectrum is that we have a reputation that we do this, so it's a lot easier. If I was just starting out, I would talk to the administration and just let them know the benefits outweigh the cost for like the liposomal bupivacaine, for the ultrasound machine. This is how much time we could save in the operating room. This is less medication. You will get patient satisfaction. It's easy to learn. We could do bigger cases in the ASC. We could do sicker patients in the ASC. Even some areas of the country, they're doing ambulatory joint replacements of hips and knees. We have one of our surgery centers where they do cervical fusions. Single-level cervical fusions, ambulatory, which is more business from an administrator like yourself, John. That's what you're looking at. Bigger cases, more reimbursement, mm-hmm. and obviously patient satisfaction and safety. Because in everything we do, the patient's safety is still our number one priority.
You mentioned the risk of immunosuppression, especially when you're doing mastectomies.
That's another big form of research. I was in my talk today. Thanks for bringing that up, Susan. Mm-hmm. Was about breast cancer surgery, lumpectomies, mastectomies. Anytime we have a surgical incision, we have pro-inflammatory mediators getting released that decreases our immunity. So when you have an issue like breast cancer, there's a chance of recurrence. These nerve blocks with the local infiltration or the regional anesthesia could help mitigate this response to this immunosuppression from surgical stress. We will always have surgical stress, no mm-hmm. matter how we change around anything. Anytime we make an incision, our body will release a ton of mediators. But these local anesthetics and regional anesthesia techniques that we're able to provide to AABP and other anesthesiologists helps mitigate this response and hopefully reduce the risk of recurrence. There's some studies that show that it does now. It's not...
It's new research, it's really interesting, I think.
Anything we could do to help people have faster recovery, easier mm-hmm. recovery, and better survival, we're going to look at. And there's less cost to society. We don't want people becoming addicted. We don't want people becoming dependent. Because yeah. once you go down that little rabbit hole, then you have more mm-hmm. people on disability. They're not becoming customers for your ASC. They're not helping society, training new people, working, supporting their families. We want a functioning society.
Yeah, hitting it from the back end is almost impossible. It's so hard
it's
to break those addictions.
It's impossible to play catch up. Look mm-hmm. at even our country with smoking. It's so hard. If yeah. you know someone that smokes, it's so hard to get them to stop. The same mm-hmm. thing is with opiate. There is also something with opiates called opiate-induced hyperalgesia. So if you take opiates for a long time or large doses, you could become more sensitive to pain.
Okay.
In my personal experience in my pain practice, I've had people come to me who were maybe not happy with their care or they were on high doses, and I titrate them down. I have many patients who are on 1/10 the dose they were on with better pain control. And a lot of my patients, I get off the opiates, and their pain does not change.
So, Dr. Schwartz, you know, for our audience and for our average ASC, probably one of the things they want to hear is how are we going to integrate this into our quality improvement program? What types of things can we take out of that? What type of data can we use as part of, you know, proving that we're providing better care, you know, statistically turning this into a QI study, for example, and demonstrating, identifying a problem, identifying a solution, and then demonstrating, measurable improvement in that. So
I think as a QI project, this would actually be a very more of a simple project to do is that it's all in the news every day, as we spoke mm-hmm. about before. Right. You could say we have an opiate problem in this country. You could look back at previous data in the center and see how much opiate you are using currently for your cases. You implement these nerve blocks and say, in 1 year time, we are using X, Y, and Z less. Yeah. Our surgeons were previously prescribing, let's say, 20 opiates after each procedure, 50 opiates. Now they are giving 5 or 10. We even mm-hmm. in our hospital, we have a universal protocol that we're using as part of that QI project to mandate opiate sparing protocols and a discussion between the surgeon, anesthesiologist, nursing prior to the surgery of how we're going to spare these medications during the operation mm-hmm. and also for the postoperative amount. And you have your historical data to compare it to mm-hmm. of how much opiate you were using before for each case. And you could find out from your surgeons and your ASCs of what they're dispensing. And then if you change those protocols now that, hey, we're going to only give half the amount postoperatively and we're obviously using less intraoperatively and in the recovery room secondary to these measures, there's your outcome measure.
Mm-hmm. And what we end up with here is a QI study that not only demonstrates helping to solve a national crisis right now, but also providing a financial incentive for the organization in cutting costs, mm-hmm. and as well as there's the very personal part of, you know, obviously helping that individual to have a, you know, a better quality of life. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Schwartz. This has been great.
Thank you guys very much. I look forward to the rest of the conference. Thank you.
Same here. One of the biggest challenges for ambulatory surgery centers is making sure that they appropriately screen patients prior to surgery to minimize the risk of canceling the case on the day of surgery. If the anesthesiologist is the person that cancels the case, often this results in friction between the surgeon and the anesthesiologist. During the Spring New York State Association of ASCs conference in May, we were able to speak to Dr. Tel Levy, an anesthesiologist, who spoke at the conference about an anesthesiologist's perspective on appropriate patient selection, and Sandy Wells, the nursing director at EMU Surgical Center in New York City, who provided a facility perspective. Let's listen to the interview.
We're here with Tal Levy, MD, MBA, an anesthesiologist in New York City, and Sandy Wells, RN, MSN, Director of Nursing at EMU Surgical Center in Queens.
So I'm actually here with two of my favorite people. As much as I pick on you all the time, you are my favorite people. So thank you so much for coming here.
Thank
and Tal, thank you for stepping up to do this session. You were perfect. She's a great anesthesiologist here. And when we're looking for somebody to talk about the topic of appropriate patient selection, I thought you would be a perfect one to talk about. And Sandy, you're here because you're providing that nurse management perspective here.
Happy to do so.
But you're going to have to be a lot closer to the mic to be
okay,
happy to.
Sorry.
There we go. So the session was, or will be, we actually haven't done it yet here, is a session on the appropriate patient selection here. So actually, I'm going to start with Sandy. As a nurse administrator, one of our biggest challenges in a surgery center is just making sure that we don't cancel cases because the patient that walks through the door is totally inappropriate. Can you just give a little perspective on the types of challenges that you find as a nurse administrator running a surgery center and the types of things that happen when we don't do appropriate patient selection?
Sure. As you know, for the most part, surgery centers will do Class A or ASA 1, ASA 2 patients, ASA 3, if perhaps they are a local case. ASA4s obviously are unacceptable candidates for an ambulatory surgical setting. But I have found in the past that if you delineate your pre-admission testing protocol and have clear communication with the physicians, then that does help reduce your cancellation and your waiting time rate. However, on occasion, you do have that patient that slips through. And for some reason, the pre-admission testing protocol was not accomplished or was not completed, then it really is up to the anesthesiologist. And there, sometimes, you know, the question is subjective between different anesthesiologists' opinions of what should be required prior to surgery. But in the end, it really is based on the patient's overall general state of health that the anesthesiologist is going to decide whether or not to do that case. But I found that clear communication with the doctors of knowing exactly whatever the patient's history is, such as hypertension, then we are going to want to see an EKG. And after a while, when they find that we necessarily may not do the case, they kind of come around and they train their offices to make sure that it's
done. Be better
done.
Selection, yeah.
Yeah. I found the real key is communication.
So we as surveyors wanted to assure that the organization has identified the types of patients that are appropriate candidates for surgery. So that gets to you, Tal. And this is your opportunity. So many times, of course, the anesthesiologist is the last person to be consulted about that. So that's why you're speaking here and not like the eye doctor who says that every single patient can come in here because you're just going to poke the eye. You know, nothing's going to happen there. So tell us a little bit about your approach to it and what your observations are in that area.
So I think as we're moving more and more cases into an ambulatory setting, more of what we're looking for is not a preoperative clearance. What we're looking for is risk stratification. Basically, what that means is we're looking at the level of acuity of the patient's condition and the level of acuity of the case that we're actually trying to do. So we are actually taking care of more and more ASA 3 patients in an ambulatory setting. But again, it's about how we can optimize the patient's condition prior to the patient coming to the surgery center. And also, what types of cases can we do with these types of patients?
So you're going to evaluate a patient coming in for cataract surgery very differently than somebody that's going to go under general anesthesia.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm talking about. I actually always go back to guidelines from the American Society of Anesthesiologists, and that helps guide me as to what I actually want to do when I'm looking at risk stratifying a patient. In these guidelines, they talk again about the level of acuity of the case. So a minor case, you may not need additional testing in a patient that has had a primary care doctor visit in the last 6 months or so. They can come in with a history and physical exam from a primary care doctor, and they may not need any additional testing, including not even needing an EKG for a cataract. On the other hand, if they're coming in for a general anesthetic, we may need a little bit more information to determine what their level of risk is as far as, you know, if we need them to stay overnight afterwards, we're not going to do that case in an ambulatory surgery center.
Right. So what do you suggest when you're working with somebody like Sandy and putting together the policies and procedures? Or, and by the way, I don't always recommend that it be in the policies and procedures because sometimes that becomes too prescriptive. So I believe in EMU, you have a protocol, for example, for this. So when the two of you work together, and by the way, the two of you did work together for a while, just talk a little bit about how you put those together.
So one of the things we tried to do was actually get the information about the patients in advance of the day of surgery. I really believe that having this information available allows us to get more information that may, in fact, allow us to do the procedure on the day of surgery and not have same-day cancellations. And I think that's the biggest problem that we have in ASCs is same-day cancellations. We're all set up for a procedure, and at the last minute, the anesthesiologist says, no, we can't go ahead with it.
Which is kind of a funny thing to be talking about here because it seems kind of obvious to me that you should be looking toward the patient prior to surgery. But we know a lot of people out there, a lot of doctors out there are not doing that. So that's the number one. I mean, that's certainly the first thing you need to do.
And we do encourage to have all the pre-admission testing sent over with the booking sheets prior to the procedure. And we actually prefer it a couple of days before. That way, if we do see any outliers, we can bring the chart to one of the anesthesiologists. And then they can review it prior. They may want to have the patient come in earlier to evaluate their airway. For example.
Especially if their BMI is over a certain level or if you have some airway issues already identified.
Or if they see their height. Yeah, exactly. With the BMI, they see their height and weight and they're thinking, you know, maybe let's make sure this person's airway is appropriate for an ambulatory surgery setting.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, Tal, because this is a big topic right now. I mean, I'm seeing BMIs. I saw a center the other day, 35. Anything above 35, they want to have somebody in. And then I have another one that says, yeah, 55. So,
I mean, I think that BMI, just using BMI as your only criteria is problematic. I think that you have to look at other things in addition to the BMI. So any comorbidities that the patient has, anything that might make you think that the patient would have a difficult airway. And there are certain criteria that we look at when we are evaluating an airway that I think we can sort of let other people know about to help determine other criteria that we can use to sort of determine if this airway might be difficult. And the other issue is what adjunct airway devices do you have in your center that may make you more likely to do more complicated cases than in other centers?
So I think kind of what you're saying too here is that just to put a blanket, and the surgeons want to hear this too. I mean, this is important to them. Just putting a blanket statement that anybody over 40 or over 45 are not appropriate candidates is not the best way to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, just using one criteria is not really enough.
Right.
And 35, I think, is a very low cutoff, especially in this country.
Yeah, I'm way above that number.
I mean, the fact is that, you know, with the obesity epidemic in this country, 35 is really the new 25, I guess. So, using 35 alone is not a good standard.
Right. So what other, so you talked about, I mean, physiology is going to be another issue. But so when I'm thinking about this, this isn't stuff you can be assessing on the day of surgery.
Exactly.
You know, and of course, maybe the only thing that you're getting is the BMI before that. So just flagging them, you know, I've always been an advocate of having nurses call the patient, you know, a week before surgery. I don't believe that's done in your particular center, right?
The pre-op calls are done the day before, yes.
Day before.
But again, we've had some outliers that we discovered the day before also. So yes, I agree with you. If we had the information a couple of days earlier, it would be helpful.
Yeah. And of course, it's all organizations are very different. You know, a lot of the organizations that I'm referring to are places that the patient was scheduled probably a month ahead of time. And it's kind of like the ideal situation where you're able to look, you know, a nurse can call a week beforehand and just run through a series of screening questions. So for the benefit of our listeners who might not even know how to start something like that, let's just talk about that for a second. If you, in an ideal world, Tal, you probably would love to have a nurse calling six weeks beforehand. But, you know, weeks beforehand or a week beforehand and getting this information, if you were living in fantasy world right now, fantasy land, what would be those ideal questions? Just quick ones, you know, that you find that would help screen those patients so that you could then know that you're going to have to do some more work with them.
Okay. I mean, I think just getting a basic history, knowing what the patient's comorbidities are in advance is really helpful because that helps determine what other testing you need. Again, sometimes you don't need any further testing and patients come in having had multiple tests that are unnecessary, expensive, difficult to get. The whole point of going to an ambulatory center is to make it more convenient both for the patient and for the surgeon. And this sort of subverts that.
Right.
The other thing is having a phone call 6 weeks in advance. I mean, I think that would be insane. Even in the perfect world, I think that's too far in advance.
Yeah. But you probably could get a lot sicker in that time frame. But,
absolutely.
But a week
a lot of things can change. I think even having a call the day before is helpful.
Yeah.
And I think also sort of letting people know that a lot of this perioperative testing is unnecessary. We just really need a good history and a little bit of a physical exam. And even if it's done on the day of surgery, we'll have some idea of how to adjust our anesthetic accordingly.
So again, we had a previous speaker that we were just talking to, and he was coming up. We're talking about the opioid crisis and about how you can actually save money by doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're actually saying here is that we can save the system money.
Absolutely.
We can assure that you're going to have lower cancellations, because there's no doubt that cancellation rate is going to go down, even with the most simple basic stuff that we really are kind of inferring here. So that's the best way to kind of improve the system, improve the outcomes, et cetera. I want to talk a little bit about, Sandy, you and I are passionate, absolutely passionate. By the way, Sandy is a surveyor with HHHC also, and we're just great colleagues here. So I know you are passionate about quality improvement like I am. So let's just talk for a second about the tie-in between what Tal is talking about with regard to appropriate, you know, patient selection, and how we push that into the quality improvement and how we use that to improve our quality improvement program.
Well, the criteria and the testing protocol that is determined by the anesthesiologist or the anesthesiology department at a surgery center directly affects our possibly cancellation times, our wait times, the patient selection. You really need to have complete communication with your anesthesiology group. Because, so for example, just as Tal pointed out, at our center, we do a significant amount of cataract surgery.
Yeah.
Now, a patient with cataract surgery, yes, it's not that we're just doing a 5-minute eye procedure. However, if the patient is in their usual good state of health, but they had 4 stents and they have hypertension, that does not necessarily mean that you have to have a complete cardiac clearance, an EKG,
and a stress
test to have a cataract procedure done. So obviously it is variable depending on what your center's protocol is. But
I also smell a quality improvement study here.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely a good item to look at.
I think another point Sandy made was about the wait times. The more complex the patients that you're attempting to do, the longer it may take for the anesthetic. For example, if you have a patient with a difficult airway, you have to factor that into your surgical times, that it may take longer and you may need extra hands to help out securing a difficult airway for a general case. So I think you have to take that into consideration when you're doing more complex patients.
And unfortunately, with this day and age of cost savings and reducing expenses, in the perfect world of being able to call patients a couple of weeks before would be great, except unfortunately you also call them the day before for times.
Yeah.
So you're making 2 phone calls, and that also takes more manpower.
Yeah, agreed. But I do think that there's a lot to be gained. I think it's all too often we, as the people in the center that are dealing with the patient on the day of surgery, have to deal with perhaps people that have chosen to push patients to us that have really had very little preparation.
Agreed.
And what we're trying to do is we have to go back and we have to prove, maybe this is through QI studies, maybe it's from, literally Tal you saying, I'm going to start canceling a lot more of your cases if you don't give me better patient selection up front. There is a cost involved in this, and the doctors don't like cancel cases because it means that they've lost revenue, and they've got a hole in their schedule. And the more we talk to them up front about why this is an important thing, the better your outcome's going to be.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's really about, as you said, it's about patient selection, but who's doing the patient selection? I think it's when it's left up to the surgeons, some surgeons have different criteria for what types of patients they want to do in an ambulatory center, whereas I think anesthesiologists have different criteria that they're looking at as far as what they want done in a center.
And in the end, it's quality care. We want the best patient selection for the setting that they will be having the procedure in.
Agreed.
And that sounds like a good way to end this segment. Thank you so much. I appreciate both your time, Sandy and Tal. Thanks again.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to conclude this section by adding a few notes about appropriate patient selection and its impact on your organization and quality improvement. This is an area that surveyors will look at during a survey, and the selection criteria that you use for your organization doesn't necessarily need to be in policy. It can be in a protocol, but it should be in writing. It should be something that can be provided to surveyors and, of course, available to all the providers in your organization so they understand what you are looking for when you're choosing patients or determining the types of patients that your organization will accept. This should be a very good conversation as part of your quality improvement meetings, your medical executive meetings, and your governing body meetings, where really these decisions need to be made. These are not decisions that should be made by administration, but by healthcare providers. And there should be a real honest conversation between the surgeons and anesthesiologists to avoid those types of discussions that occur often during the surgery day that can be quite disrupting for your staff and for the patients. Consider the options, as we discussed in the interview, for obtaining patient history, including possibly using nurses to interview patients prior to surgery so that you can get this information, provide it to the anesthesiologist prior to the day of surgery so that they can make some good decisions, get additional information if they need any, and have a conversation with the surgeons before the date of surgery to avoid any disruptions on the day of surgery. Good patient selection will reduce cancellations on the day of surgery. It's good for doctors because obviously they don't like to have their schedule interrupted during the day. Any case that is canceled on the day of surgery means lost revenue for them and a disruption in their schedule. It's good for the facility for the same reasons, and it's good for the patients. You don't, especially some of the patients that have to, for example, with GI procedures who go through a quite arduous process to prepare for the surgery, they don't like cancellations any more than we do, and improving quality in this area means making sure that we reduce the number of cancellations. Always a good idea to track cancellations and follow up on trends as part of your quality improvement process, and use this to assure that you are identifying opportunities for improvement or situations in which you might want to change your processes in order to make sure that cancellations are reduced. Learn from this experience and revise your protocols as necessary to improve the quality in your organization. Let's take a short break and we'll discuss upcoming events in the podcast and in the ASC industry. So as we mentioned earlier, if you are a CASC certificant and wish to get AEU credit in the area of provision of patient care, you can get one AEU credit for listening to this podcast. In order to do that, go to our website at www.ascpodcast.com, follow the links for AEU credits, and enter the following code in the link there, as well as the name that you wish to have on your certificate. And then there's a nominal fee of $35 for the certificate. The code is PH0516. That's P as in Peter, H as in Harry, 0516. Enter that with the name that you wish to have on your certificate, pay the $35 fee, and we'll send you off a certificate.
Let's talk about what's coming up on the ASC podcast with John Gailey. Each week, we discuss the latest news in the industry, discuss upcoming events, and review one or two areas of interest to ASC professionals.
Our June 11th episode will be discussing Medicare quality reporting with our guest, Gina Thronberry from the ASC Association. On June 18th, we'll finally start straying out of our regulatory compliance for a week and discuss information technology, EMR, and cybersecurity with our guest, Nelson Gomes. On June 25th, we'll be talking about safety, both patient and employee, and we'll have our guest speaker, Betsy McCoy. And on July 2nd, we'll have another extended podcast on employee orientation, education, and in-services. And this episode will also have AEU credits.
All podcast content is subject to change if something important comes up that we have to address.
So, Sue, let's talk about what's coming up in the ASC industry.
Okay, each week we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
Note that we also have a calendar of events on our website at www.ascpodcast.com.
The New Jersey Association of ASC's 8th Annual Ambulatory Surgery Conference is June 12th and June 13th at the Wilshire Grand Hotel.
Becker's 16th Annual Future of Spine, the Spine Orthopedic and Pain Management-Driven ASC Conference, is June 14th through the 16th, 2018, at the Swiss Hotel in Chicago, Illinois.
Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association Annual Conference, June 28th and 29th, 2018, at the JW Marriott Camelback Inn and Spa in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Registration for the online CAPE exam that will be administered during the month of October at various testing centers throughout the United States is August 1st through the 31st, 2018. To register, go to www.aboutcaip.org. That's www.aboutcaip.org.
California Ambulatory Surgery Association, CASA Annual Conference, September 5th through 7th, 2018 in Huntington Beach.
The Ohio State Association meeting will be September 18th through the 20th at the Hilton Polaris in Columbus, Ohio.
The 5th Annual New York Metro ASC Symposium, November 2nd, 2018 at the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square.
The California Association Infection Prevention Seminar is November 7th and 8th in 2018 in Costa Mesa.
Registration for the online CASC exam that will be administered during the month of October at various testing centers throughout the United States is August 1st through 31st, 2018. To register, go to www.aboutcasc.org. That's www.aboutcasc.org.
If you would like your event listed on our website and discussed on air, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. Well, that's it for this week's podcast, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and hit that subscribe button. See you next week.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.